Hello and welcome to the WPAOG podcast. This episode features an interview with Major Nargis Kabiri, Army Marketing Officer and West Point Class of 2010 grad. Major Kabiri is an Army Marketing Officer and a mother of three who immigrated to the United States from Afghanistan in 1986. She enlisted in the Army at age 17 and would later get recruited to play basketball for West Point. In 2010, she received her Bachelor of Science in Systems Engineering and commissioned as a field artillery officer, becoming a litmus test for the Army to lift the combat exclusion policy in 2012. In addition to her military experience, she founded Zimbazin, a revolutionary nursing apparel startup, and co-founded Athena Angels, providing educational programming and mentorship opportunities for West Point women entrepreneurs. In this episode, Major Kabiri talks about the trials and tribulations of growing up as an Afghan American in the United States, turning to sports as an outlet during her time at West Point, and how her journey as a commissioned field artillery officer transpired into a path towards entrepreneurship. Now, please enjoy this interview between Major Nargis Kabiri, Army Marketing Officer and West Point Class of 2010 grad, and your host, Laura McKenna, founder of Strength and Shield Coaching, West Point Class of 2001.
My name is Laura McKenna. I am a West Point graduate class of 2001. I was back on the faculty in the Department of Physical Education. I taught survival swimming and combatives from 2010 to 2014. And now I'm off in the civilian world. I was a military police officer and then a Black Hawk pilot while on active duty. Left after teaching at West Point, transitioned to the civilian world. I now am a business strategist and planner for a major corporation. And I also own an enterprise called Strength and Shield Coaching LLC. And it is through that network, the West Point Women Entrepreneur Network, that I met Nargis. And so, Nargis, if you would introduce yourself, I'm super excited to hear from you today.
Thank you, Laura. I'm super happy to be here today and talking with you. My name is Nargis Kabiri. I'm class of 2010. I was also on the faculty in Department of Physical Education, and now I work in admissions. I commissioned as a field artillery officer in 2010, and I'm currently in a functional area, FA-58, Army Marketing.
So, Nargis, I'm really excited to be talking to you. I want to hear all your stories. So let's start with how you ended up at West Point. Like, what brought you to West Point? Why did you choose it?
Well, yeah, thanks, Laura. I'm really excited to be doing this with you as well. So a few of you guys may know that my family is first-generation American, so immigrated from a very young age. And from early on, we learned discipline. And what's interesting is, you know, everything that the Army is, the Army values, is what I grew up as my personal values. So it made sense for me. But before I even went to West Point, I had enlisted in the Army when I was 17 years old. A huge part of that was just because I knew I wanted to get an education in the state of Minnesota. The National Guard paid for 80%. Like, a lot of it was just me trying to figure out the next step. Growing up, I always had a job since the age of 8. You know, we could talk about that more later. But so there I was, 17 years old. I joined the National Guard, and that was my junior year. And next thing I know, my senior year, there's a coach, a recruiter from West Point for basketball. Basketball has always been a huge part of my life. It's always kind of been my outlet, my go-to for any time I was stressed out. And it was my one thing I had going for me. It was mine. And so come senior year, I went out to West Point for a recruiting visit. And like I said, everything just felt natural. It fit. I felt like I belonged with the team. Like, even though I just met the girls, I felt like we were just long lost friends. And it was that work ethic. It was that, you know, desire to succeed. It was maybe that type A personality. And I just thought, yes, this is where I belong. Not going to lie, it definitely helped that, you know, I was told, hey, you don't have to work when you're here. You just have to focus on school and basketball. And oh, by the way, we pay you to do that. So I was like, where do I sign up? So yeah, you know, I know like you had a long lineage of military and West Point grads in your family. For me, I really feel like I was blessed and really lucky to stumble upon this opportunity and never looked back after I said yes.
Yeah. So there's so many elements there that I want to talk to you about. I'm going to zoom in for a sec on that aspect of you that is an athlete. And it sounds like that is and was an outlet for you, you know, physically. It gave you a sense of belonging. It was a place where you could work to achieve your potential. You had a sense of camaraderie. You were able to bring out your competitive side. Like, tell me more about your identity as an athlete and then how that also led you later in your military career. I know you and I both taught in DPE, although at different times. So how did that inform, you know, that process and that decision to come back to West Point on the faculty?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I truly believe every child needs to be in some sort of athletics. And I don't care what that sport is. You know, I don't care if it's bowling. It could be a team sport or individual. I thrived in team sports because there's that individual component of taking care of yourself, right place, right time, right uniform. But not only that, but like the individual aspect of creating smart goals where you set out for a goal and you have tangible results almost immediately. You stick to a goal, you stick with that, and then it teaches you that discipline and the hard work. And at the end of the day, you obtain your goal, right? So on the individual side, I mean, what better way to gain confidence in yourself? What better way to show that, hey, you work hard for something, you stick with it, you know, long-term passion and perseverance to achieve your long-term goals, the grit that comes with that, because then you start growing as a person, your character grows, and then you start to become a leader. And so now we're looking at the team aspect. So now you've led yourself to where you need to be in your optimal performance, both not just physically, right? There's also a mental component to this. There's that mental resiliency, not giving up. And then now trying to impart that same attitude, those same attributes and those values to your team members and just seeing that ripple effect, right? Because everybody on the team has a ripple effect and it's up to you as an individual. Is that going to be positive? And you don't have to be a team captain. I tell people that all the time. You just show up every day and you have that positive attitude and man, that ripple effect just goes through team. So there's no better way to learn leadership and self-confidence than through sports. And so, yeah, very much so. It's been my identity my entire life. And for the most part, it's always been basketball, but just overall being an athlete has been a huge part of that. And that theme comes through over and over for me. So not just in high school. I mean, I'll be honest, the odds were stacked against me. We were poor. My dad passed away when I was 6 years old. You know, like we didn't have any money, but what kept me going was sports and not just from the tangible aspects of getting a scholarship for college, but just also the social aspects. Like my family, we were outcasts. We were in the middle of a small town in Minnesota. There weren't too many other Afghans or Muslims there. In fact, we were the only family there. And so we were social outcasts. We did not belong. But being on a team, I immediately belonged, whether people wanted that or not, I belonged. And so now you take that into West Point. And it was the same thing because now you're being challenged in Arvin Gym. And I would tell you, Arvin Gym, I've had my highest highs and my lowest lows in that gym. I've had the most growth experience in that gym. I've had some of the best mentors from that gym. And so it only seemed fitting that I go back and try to give back. And then also in the Army, the biggest thing. So I was the litmus test for allowing women in combat arms in 2012. And you know how they chose me? Because I was physically fit. That's what it came down to. They didn't care that I had the technical and tactical expertise. What they did care about was that I could do, you know, 11 pull-ups and that I could run. You know, all they cared about was I could ruck run. I could do everything with the guys because at the time, this was back in 2012, the number one argument was that women couldn't hack it out physically. And so that toughness, that grit, that never quit mentality, it was always there because you bet every single day, every single morning for PT, eyes were on me. Growing into my confidence and I would say my physique, you know, West Point taught me a lot about health and fitness and nutrition. And that was something that I didn't know. I kind of took it for granted when I was in high school because, you know, you could eat pizza and cookies all day and not gain a pound. And then you come into West Point and that's not the same thing. And so there's so much that I learned just through the physical attributes and our physical pillar at West Point.
Yeah. And there are so many things that you talked about there that, one, I resonate with, and then I want to kind of dig deeper into. Like, I really connect with that element of sense of belonging. Like, when you're a member of a team, nothing else matters except your being a member of that team. And so it is sort of a great equalizer. And I totally agree that sport and physical fitness is, I think, the best microcosm for teaching personal and organizational leadership. So just really spot on there. And I also love that you shared, like, basketball is mine. Like, that's how I feel about CrossFit. Like, I've always been an athlete, and it's really important to me. I consider it like the best part of my day because it's mine. It's the thing I do that is just for me. And so I definitely resonate with that. So if we can kind of back up a little bit, and then we'll come back to West Point and to your career. One of the things that drew me to you, and we connected almost immediately after, shortly after the American forces left Afghanistan. And that's when I first learned your story. And having deployed to Afghanistan, I was military police at the time. And so we, the women military police, interacted with many Afghan women and girls. And so that has been very close to my heart. Tell me more about your identity as Afghan and as American. What was it like being, you know, an immigrant, you know, in a small town? How did you get past being the child of a single mom and the loss of your dad? I mean, so many like challenges that you have overcome. How's your identity as Afghan, and has your experiences as a child really brought you to where you are in your life?
It starts off with, and you mentioned it, you know, so losing my dad at a very young age. So my dad was very unique in that he was quite progressive for that time frame and for being, you know, a male Afghan. He was huge. He harped on education for all of us kids, especially for the women. So there were four girls, two boys. I was the youngest of the six. And so, you know, the story that my mom tells me is, hey, she made a promise to our dad before he passed away that as long as the girls get a college education, you know, we could choose who we wanted to marry. Doesn't that sound crazy? We could choose our spouses. And for him, the biggest thing was he wanted women to be independent. Because if you think about it, my mom was very dependent on him. We immigrated to the United States. She didn't speak any English. She was learning. She was going through some of the ESL classes. He just had a lot of pressure because he had to provide for all seven of us. And then when he abruptly passed away, he passed away unexpectedly in a car accident. My mom was just left to do what she could do. And I think that's where I get my mentality, the never quit, the grit that comes with that, the hard work, because it would have been too easy for my mom to go back to Afghanistan. In fact, all of her family called her and said, it's time for you to come back. Like, come back, we'll take care of you guys. But my mom just kept remembering her promise to my dad, which was, nope, these girls need an education. And that was her big thing. And so she stuck through. I mean, she stuck with it. The easy answer would have been like, okay, let me go back. But, you know, she saw bigger things for us. She wanted more for us, you know, than what she had. And her story was unique in that she went from a riches to rags story. So meaning her family was very prominent. She had a very good lifestyle. She had cook, cleaners, drivers, like, and then coming to the US, she lost everything. But those were the sacrifices that she made for us and to push us forward. So, you know, seeing that, you know, there's that saying, Afghan people are very stubborn. I guess it's through that stubbornness my mom pushed through. And I saw that. And I saw that she never quit. She did everything that she could do that she knew how to do. So she was working at hotels, cleaning. She was working at the bakery, baking. She was sewing, you know, doing tailoring and whatnot, whatever she could do, any odd and end jobs. And then, of course, you know, it comes back to that team aspect. So myself and my siblings, we all found ourselves working together collectively to keep the whole house floating. It wasn't like an individual thing. It wasn't like, hey, I'm going to work this job so I can buy myself an iPod. That was never the mentality. It was, I'm going to work here so that I could provide for the family you know, in these ways. So growing up with that mentality, I think definitely helped with the mental resilience and that hard work ethic that you need to have to succeed, not just at West Point, but in the military and in life in general. So then you mentioned the recent events, the current events in Afghanistan. Well, first, I'm going to back up there because, of course, 9/11 happened. And as I mentioned, I was in a very small town. I remember I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened. It was a very difficult time. It was difficult because, you know, immediately we were ostracized. You know, like here we had immigrated to the country and then we moved into this small town almost immediately after. I had grown up in this small town and people that I would have considered to be close to me. And next thing I know, like none of that existed. It just kind of felt like that entire support system was just taken out from underneath us. But, you know, instead of meeting fear with fear or hatred with hatred, I had to really pull back and I had to really think like, this is a time to educate. I think before 9/11, nobody could tell you where Afghanistan was located on a map, or at least most people couldn't tell you, right? And so when this had happened, I had to educate a lot of people and some listened and some just didn't, but I had to just keep voicing. I had to be that bridge between that gap of knowledge. There's, you know, here's the U.S. population, but oh, by the way, there's also this innocent Afghan population. So the people who conducted 9/11, those people are terrorists. Even though they're from Afghanistan, they were still terrorizing other Afghans, innocent Afghans. And I think that was such an important thing to note. And I think people would forget that, like, hey, you know, terrorism, it's not just populated at one person. It's just their ideas. It's their beliefs. It's an extreme version of how to rule something or someone or a country. Sticking to that, and I knew I had a skill and an understanding of both languages and both cultures, I was really drawn to the Army. And as I mentioned, I had no military background. I really didn't know what I was doing. But I remember talking to our Army recruiter and next thing I know, I'm enlisting. And it just, it, to me, it felt right. It felt right to serve because here I had this skill set that was just, it was needed. And it was, you know, and that has come to fruition time and again in my career, not just in my military career, but even when I was a cadet. So in 2008, I had an IAD and I traveled with all the department heads to go to the National Military Academy of Afghanistan. Here I am as a cadet. I'm traveling to Afghanistan with like 10 full bird colonels, all of which assume the role of dad. Very protective. I loved it. Such a great time. But to date, I'm pretty sure I am the first, the only, and the last cadet to ever be in a war zone, ever. But they loved it. And what an impact, because I got to meet with all the cadets there. And at the time, it was just male cadets. And so one of the projects that I worked on was incorporating Afghan women to NEMA, the Afghan Military Academy, which was modeled after West Point. So think about that. This academy was just maybe 3 years old, and they were already looking at how do we get women into our academy? Look at how long it took West Point. It was so amazing to change the hearts and minds of the Afghan cadets. And these Afghan cadets that I met way back in 2008 would now be captains and majors, and they were leading the Afghan forces, even as Afghanistan fell, to which some of them I still stay in touch with. But I recall they would say things like, you know, before you, we used to think that women were not capable of much. And now, you know, we want daughters like you. We want them to be independent and strong. And so like, for me, that was a huge win in my book because you had to just show them, hey, 50% of your population is not, I mean, they could contribute to so much. And so you see that shift. You see the paradigm shifting in Afghan culture and Afghan people. And so you're looking at, you know, when we talk about the fall of Afghanistan, I put it into three buckets. You know, there's the impact on the Afghan people and the populace. There's the impact on us military veterans who've all deployed and had interactions with Afghans. And then the other bucket is like my personal bucket, you know, my own personal relationships and family and the impacts of the fall. And so for the Afghan people, we did some amazing things. We changed their outlook. The whole paradigm shifted. They were elevating and promoting and championing women to do great things. They were in the workboat, in the workforce. So we changed an entire generation. Think about that. You know, 20 years. And we did that.
So many things that you shared there that I would love to dig into. I swear we could do like three other podcasts. There are a couple areas that I want to focus us back in on. You know, just the grit and resilience that you learned growing up and from your mom, and the difference that you made as a cadet in the lives of those Afghan cadets as you were speaking to them, like literally changing minds, shifting paradigms. That's incredible. Like, what a difference that you have made in the world. And I see you doing that in other areas of your life as well. So your entrepreneurial journey, world-changing, game-changing, having had both of my kids while I was on active duty, I definitely want to talk about your entrepreneurial enterprise because I think it is totally game-changing for active duty moms. But let's first talk about being field artillery. That's an area we haven't, you know, really, I think, covered yet. So talk to me about why you chose artillery, because being one of the first women in combat roles in field artillery and having to really prove yourself, like, I want to hear about that. Why did you choose it? And what was that experience like? And then I want to ask you about how you became an entrepreneur.
Field artillery was not even on my radar coming up as a cadet. In fact, this is how little I knew about it. I didn't think women could go field artillery. So at this time, at a very young age, like as a plebe, I thought I wanted to go MI, military intelligence. I thought that was where I belong. Spoke fluent Dari. I studied Arabic. I thought that was my trajectory. I did a couple of things that were MI related. So for example, we do our cadet leadership, our CTLT, which is where you shadow a second lieutenant in a branch that you think you're interested in. And as much as I enjoyed the people and my time, it was in Hawaii, so you can't complain. The job itself just didn't seem very appealing. I'm like, wow, this is really not at all what I wanted to do or see myself doing. And now fast forward to when I went semester abroad, a very similar situation. And so again, this is kind of funny because this is how basketball comes back into my life. So when I was semester abroad in Jordan studying Arabic, every Tuesday, I would play pickup basketball at the embassy. And so every Tuesday I was going to the embassy, and next thing I know, like I had no idea who I was playing basketball with. Some were agents, some were attachés, some were just random folks. But you know what? All I saw them in were t-shirts and shorts, and I saw them as, you know, competition. I was going to definitely beat them in basketball. So after a few iterations of this, I had an older gentleman come up to me and just start to ask me questions. And they knew I was a West Point cadet. They knew I was a former basketball player, but they didn't know that I was Afghan. They didn't know that I spoke Dari. After speaking a little bit, they're like, hey, you know, how would you feel about shadowing us on some of our operations? And I was just like, yeah, sign me up. You know, what do I got to do? So at this time, I already had my top secret clearance, and I went on some low level operations. And it was an eye opener because what it taught me was, as much as I have respect for these operations and all these things that go on, things that you would just never think about, it made me realize, like, you have to have this level of a set of characteristics and attributes that I did not possess, meaning I was not going to be a good fit for it. For example, I am an open book. I wear my emotions on my sleeve. I am not good in the deception game. And so it just made me realize, like, this is not a good fit for me. It felt very wrong internally. I was even offered a job and I just thought, can't do it. I wouldn't be successful. So this kind of stuck with me. This was the trend, and I faced this quite a bit. And I just realized, like, I'm not going to be a good MI officer. And I respect what MI officers do. Like, you know, we couldn't survive as a military. As you know, we couldn't survive with what they do and the information that they provide. But I just knew I was not going to be a good MI officer. So next thing I know, I come back from semester abroad. Next thing I know, it's my first year and we have to put in branch preferences. And I'm internally struggling. I'm like, what do I do? Like, I thought MI was the way to go. By this time I had a lot of mentors who were MI, and so at the same time, I was doing CrossFit every morning. This was Black and Gold CrossFit before they officially became Black and Gold CrossFit. And one of my mentors, same things, very, very similar story. I had no idea who he was. I just knew he was an officer, but he wore Army PTs every day. So I didn't know what rank. I didn't know what department. I didn't know his job. And so he was just like, hey, Nargis, what do you think about branching? Because it was coming up. And I was like, sir, I have to be honest, I have no idea. And he's like, huh. Okay, why don't you come talk to me? And I was like, okay, sure. He gives me his office number and everything. So later on that afternoon, I'm walking around in the fishbowl in Washington Hall. And I'm like, okay, where's this office? Next thing I know, I find myself in front of the field artillery branch rep office. And I knock on the door and I'm like, hi, sir. And he's like, no, just come on in. And he's like, you know, you're talking about branching and preferences. So he's like, I want to talk to you about artillery. Have you thought about it at all? And I was like, sir, never. I didn't think women could go artillery. And he goes, nope, that's where you're wrong. He's like, so check it out. Women can go artillery, but you can only do rockets, you know, rockets being long range, you know, you're not close to the fight. So then he goes on to tell me about all the cool stuff. And I'm like, this is really awesome. And then he's like, but Nargis, I have to be honest with you. And I was like, yeah. He goes, you'll never have command of a firing battery and your career will end as a captain. And I sat there and I thought about it and I thought about it and I thought about it. And I was just like, but I get to blow stuff up and be outside and have fun. And he's like, yeah. I was like, all right, I'm signing up for it. Let's do this. So he was just very honest with me. And I still was just like, well, you know what? I'll get to that hurdle when the time comes. And so I'm going to back this up because a lot of people don't know this, but women were in all roles of artillery back in the 80s until the combat exclusion policy was enacted. And so once the combat exclusion policy was enacted, it basically prevented all women from going into combat arms, being within, you know, they say boots on the ground, so being close within that knife fight. And so there was a lot of West Point women from the 80s, you know, that were artillery officers. And I was able to meet up with a lot of them during the West Point Women's Conference. And they just, man, they just, you know, ignited a whole new spark in me. And just the foundations that they laid, I was so proud to able to pick up the torch and carry it on. Because for a while there, the torch was blown out. It was stagnant. I showed up to the 82nd based on mentorship feedback. I remember they're like, hey, snail mail, you got to write a letter to your brigade commander, let him know that you want to be a platoon leader and let him know why you think you'd be a great leader. So I did all of that. But when we were at Bullock, I thought it was really interesting. Our brigade commander, 18 Fires Brigade Commander, showed up. Being a Fires Brigade Commander, it was all artillery. He showed up to Fort Sill, so the home of artillery, and he pulled all of us into a formation. So this is both Bullock, all the lieutenants, and as well as Captain's Career Course. So all the soon-to-be battery commanders. And I'll never forget him, Colonel Morschauser. He was like, all right, we're going to form up. We're going to go for a run. He didn't say for how long or how fast. We started running and running and running, and we didn't stop. And these are for all the officers that were assigned to Fort Bragg, to his brigade. We had a lot of fallouts that day, And I was one of five women who was artillery in our bullet class. And out of the five women, I was the only one that was straight artillery. So I was not brand detailed. And I recall, like, we finally stopped. It ended up being about 5 miles at an 8-minute mile pace, you know, your typical Fort Bragg run. Everybody at Fort Bragg is like, yeah, okay, I could have predicted that. And I recall he's like, okay, now if you fell out, you're going to go stand over here. I remember I could overhear him say, you guys will not be a leader in my formation. I don't know what happened to them. I don't know if they got reassigned or what, but he was like hard pressed. And then for the rest of us, and I remember he made eye contact with me because I imagine there weren't too many women in those formations. And I'm sure by this time he had gotten my letter, so he knew who I was. So when I showed up to Fort Bragg, I was already airborne qualified because I did that as a cadet. And that's huge, right? Being prepared for the next job. And he's like, all right, I'm giving you a platoon leader position. And so just like that, I assumed the role of a platoon leader. So that was amazing. But I didn't stop there. So once my platoon leader time was coming up, he's like, Nargis, what do you want to be next? Because for women, we couldn't be fire support officers. We couldn't be fire direction officers. You know, there's so few things we could have done. So when he came up to me, he's like, what do you want to do next? I think he was like thinking I was going to say some sort of staff role, like, you know, S4, I really want to learn about ammunitions and, you know, like how to properly resource. But that wasn't the case. I was like, sir, I want to be an FSO. And I looked him straight in the eye and he didn't say anything. He just kind of thought about it. He was like, okay, I'll get back to you. And that was that. I didn't hear anything. Next thing I know, I was told that I got handpicked to be the first female M777 platoon leader. M777s are the new weapons system. At the time were the newer weapon systems, which is a medium-toed 155 millimeter howitzer. And back then we were the world's only airborne M777 unit. So like it was a huge, huge, huge deal. And I remember they were thinking like, you're going to be their platoon leader, but you're going to have a grand entrance. And I was just like, what are they setting me up for? Like, I was all for it. I was like, yes, let's do this. Let's do this. And the way that I met my platoon was in the field. We were doing a JOAX, a joint operational air exercise, which is the bread and butter of the 82nd. And, you know, we dropped our howitzer on the DZ and then we did another turn and then now we're jumping out of the aircraft. And so, you know, I get there, I get all my gear and I run to our designated position and I start, it's called safing the battery. And so next thing I know, or the next thing the soldiers know, there's this female voice yelling commands at them to see if the howitzers are laid on. And that was their first introduction of me. And what a way for the men in artillery to set me up for success. I mean, talk about no other way of elevating and, you know, putting women, championing women to be in those positions. And that was my leadership.
I was going to say that, and that just, yes, allyship is important, but you did the work to position yourself to be elevated. So I love that you're giving that credit to them. I think it really is indicative of your character and the quality of your spirit as a humble servant leader. But I'm also like, girlfriend, you did the work. Like, you put yourself in the position to receive that endorsement. You know, you made sure you were worthy of that endorsement and ready to receive that endorsement because you're amazing. I just want to share again, like, I know we've talked about, and you really gave the credit around, like, my leaders helped to push me, and they endorsed me and they supported me. But I think it's also really important that everything about you, you always did the work. You always put in the work and made it so that you postured yourself to be endorsed. And I think that's just absolutely fantastic. I think, you know, everything that you are describing and everything you are, you're gritty, you're resourceful, you're positive, you're passionate, you're strong and capable. I think all of those things are required for entrepreneurship. So I want to talk about that. What inspired you? And I love what you do. As I shared, I had both my kids while on active duty, and I will share a very quick story. I went through flight school with my son was 4 years old and I had just had my daughter. So I was breastfeeding my daughter while in flight school. So I would carry my flight bag and my breast pump with me to the flight line. And like right before we would go fly, I would go sit on the floor in this Vietnam era flight school bathroom with my pump, you know, plugged into the floor because there weren't any, do you know what I mean? It was not a room for breastfeeding. And I remember one day I was sitting there on the floor and I had this pump turned up to like industrial level because I needed to do this quickly, because I need to go out and like pre-flight and set up. And so I had my BDU blouse open and I had my top up. And one of my, like, she was in a different class, but she was younger than me because I went through flight school as a captain. This tiny little like lieutenant, I don't know if she didn't know what her own breasts looked like, but she was definitely not prepared for what she saw when she came into that bathroom. And I think I scarred her for life. Like, I'm certain that I terrified her because she had no idea what she was like walking into. And we locked eyes. And I remember in that moment just feeling utterly and totally alone, like that I was separate from other women, that I was separate from my peers, male or female, and that I was just alone in this like military mom fight. And that was a very distinct like moment that I remember. And so when I see now what you're doing, and I'm like, this is the coolest thing ever. It's more than just like apparel. It's more than clothing. It's a way to make being a mom, specifically in the military, easier, logistically more doable. And it takes away that separation of the moms who have young children from like the other women that they're around. And so I think it's just amazing. Like, it's so important what you're doing. So if you would just tell us a little bit about what inspired you, how you became an entrepreneur, and then just some about your entrepreneurial journey and being involved with West Point Women, being involved with the West Point Entrepreneur Group, and which you're really leading, and then founding a group called Athena Angels, which really is just facilitating entrepreneurship among West Point women. So talk to me about all of that.
Oh, Laura, my heart went out to you because that was, talk about loneliness. So here I was, for the most part, I felt very accomplished in my artillery career. I felt like I had finally made a reputation for myself. And I felt that I was respected among my peers and subordinates and senior leaders. And next thing I know, I'm showing up to Fort Stewart because I'm in the command queue and I'm dubbed as the DeVardi FCO, so fire control officer. And we just stood up Divardi, or, you know, 3rd Infantry Division just stood up their brand new Divardi. So we're going through a whole litmus of tests. And, you know, I show up and I was 10 months pregnant. Like, I had to leave Captain's Career Course early because I did not want to give birth at Fort Sill. My husband at the time was stationed at Fort Bragg. So anyways, I picked Fort Stewart because he was at Fort Bragg. Mind you, I was by name requested to both Italy and Hawaii, and I turned them both down just to be closer to my husband at the time. A month before I gave birth, they got called up for GRF and they deployed. So there I was at Fort Stewart, brand new duty station, first time mom, super pregnant, didn't know anyone around me. I show up for work for about 2 weeks. I had to get induced at 41 weeks. My oldest was the stubborn one, still is stubborn. And there I am as a first-time mom. Luckily, my mom flew in and helped me. And so I had support from her. But I didn't know which way was up. I didn't know what day of the week it was. All I knew is I had 6 weeks to get in shape. And I remember, like, I had gained over 75 pounds with him. And all I could worry about was, how am I going to look when I get back to this unit to continue my presence? And I was just really torn. So mind you, I kind of want to back up a little bit. So my son was born in 2015, and that's when they had the trial, the first female Ranger class. And up until then, I had always wanted to go to Ranger school, but I don't know if you felt this way, but the first time I held my son in my arms, I remember telling myself, I am never leaving his side. I mean, unless I have to. Like, I will never voluntarily leave his side unless the Army makes me. And I stood by that. So, like, to this day, I stood by that, you know? And so any other aspirations I had of, like, Ranger school, any other career progression type schools, I turned them down. Now, granted, I'm at a brigade level staff job. But it was that. It was just all men. And then the few female soldiers we had were like in the S1 shop, but I think they were too young to be moms, or at least I didn't know them well enough if they were moms. And so I was trying to figure out how to pump. I was trying to figure out how to deal with missing my child. I was trying to figure out how to, like, be a first-time mom in that whole life balance. And because we were, like, our op tempo was crazy, we were standing up as a new Divardi. We had all these exercises coming up. I remember telling my boss at the time, I was like, I'm not going to take lunch breaks so that I can leave by 1800 every single day, because I refused to be there at, you know, until 1900, drive 30 minutes and only see my son for like an hour. And that's like witching hour because he's tired. So we kind of had that plan. I was like, but of course, unless there was something that came up, there's always something last minute and whatnot. So the problem with that scenario was that I was in a cubicle and there was like no privacy. And so my boss was trying to be understanding. He's like, oh, use my office whenever. But he was in and out of meetings. Like, he had a lot of pressure on him. So, like, I wasn't going to use his office. Like, I needed to be more on a routine. And I was trying to figure that out. So instead, I'd go to, like, a conference room that didn't have any locks on the door. But I'd put up a chair behind the door and just sit there. And there'd be so many people trying to, like, get in and set up for the next conference. And I'm like, nope. I was like, 20 more minutes, guys. Like, just go wait somewhere. And then, you know, I would have people say stuff like, go to the bathroom. And I'm like, I'm not going to make baby food in the same place where people do other things. Like, no, that's just gross and unsanitary. But don't get me wrong. I've had to use the bathroom at a few places and like CTC rotations, because sometimes you just don't have the choice and privacy is privacy, right? So other times I would just go to my car and I'd put up my sun visors and just sit in my car. It was just such a struggle and I couldn't figure out my own time management. And here I am, like, I'd always thought, like, hey, you work hard and you put effort, you're going to achieve whatever goals you set forth. Because up until then, that had been the case. Motherhood throws all of it out. It doesn't care what your goals are. And neither does your newborn. And so, like, I had a goal where I was like, hey, I really wanted to breastfeed for 12 months because at the time that was what was recommended by the CDC. You know, nowadays it's 24 months. Like, so 12 months was my goal. And the first time I got mastitis, I was like at 6 months. The second time I got mastitis, I had made it to 8 months and it was so bad. It was so bad. I was put like on a 10-day antibiotic that ended my breastfeeding journey. And I felt like a failure. I was like, how could this be? I tried hard. I did everything in my power, but it was nothing that I could influence within my own sphere of influence. It was nothing that I could control. It was all external factors. And that bothered me. It bothered me to the nth degree. And like, talk about, you know, feeling like a failure, like the worst type of failure, the mom guilt, all that compounded with everything else. That feeling just stayed with me. So now fast forward, now I'm the first female task force FSO to 37 infantry and doing really well in my career. And then one of our final exercises, it was a CTC rotation. Even though we were light infantry, we were attached to a heavy unit. And so we were at NTC on foot. And the morning before we left for that CTC rotation, I found out I was pregnant with baby number two. And, you know, do as I say, not as I do. I should have never went. I was exhausted. I got really sick. There are times where we're out in the sun just rucking. And I didn't have enough people. I didn't have my own RTO. So I was carrying my own radios, my own extra batteries, my own everything, going up and down, you know, NTC hills and whatnot. And I was so miserable. I was so tired. Again, having another really stubborn baby. So by the time I came back from that CTC rotation, I was 16 weeks pregnant. Like, so then I was like, okay, I went into more of a staff role. We did like another warfighter function. And then finally I was in one of the S3 shops, but I ended up giving birth to my son. Actually, my command date got pushed back a little bit just because of the timing. So by this time, this was 2016. So instead of having maternity leave for 6 weeks, and oh, mind you, there was no such thing as like P3T, like our pregnancy postpartum PT and all that stuff. With my first son, it was like 6 weeks as if nothing happened. Boom, go out there and start running with the guys. And I did that, right? I pushed my body to those limits. Second time around, we at least had 12 weeks and we did have the P3T program, but I didn't have time for that because I was taking command shortly thereafter. And with my second son, I ended up having gestational diabetes and some other complications. So that was really tough because I had to get myself back into shape because now I was going to take command and I had to have that presence, you know, that physical presence in front of the soldier. And they were all men, again, all men. Even though the combat exclusion policy had been lifted, I was still in an era of just working with all men. And I remember like just working out became a second full-time job, like morning. I was doing three times a day. Like I was doing everything I could in my power just to get back into shape. And that over time, I would pay for these mistakes down the road because I pushed myself too fast, too soon. But I did it. You know, I took the PT test that first week after I assumed command. I ran, you know, a 15 something 2 mile and like, you know, lost all that weight at a really unhealthy rate. But that's just what we did. It's just what I felt was necessary, kind of going back to being a legitimate leader. And so nowadays, the policies are much more lenient, and I think people are getting more educated and wiser about the second and third order effects. But that was the time back then. And so now I'm in command. I have my own office. I can pump, you know, my office has a door. I can lock that door. I can pump with no interruptions. But you kind of forget, you know, the problem with being in field artillery, field is in our title. When I first took command, we were slated to deploy. And so we were going to the field back to back to back. We were going through our tables, our certifications, and it was nonstop. And so I remember thinking like, I have to get to 12 months this time around. And if not 12 months, I was trying to at least pump extra. So I at least had a 12-month supply when I deployed. So we're out in the field and this is Fort Stewart, Georgia. It's in the summertime. It's hot. It's humid. And the only area that I had, you know, it's open woods, right? So the only place that I had privacy was in the back of my Humvee. So I remember putting tarp down, just all, you know, no airflow, trying to pump. And like, I was so stressed out. I was working on our next movement plans as I was trying to pump. I was trying to like keep the sweat out from getting inside the pumps and like clogging up the pipes. And like, you know, it was miserable. It was a mess. And oh, my biggest fear and unhealthy amount of paranoia was I was going to have a soldier walk up on me when I was pumping and exposed and talk about, you know, losing legitimacy. I don't care how many pull-ups or how fast you can run. Like, I don't care what anyone says. If a subordinate sees you in that manner, like there goes everything, right? Everything I worked for. So I just had this irrational fear and paranoia of just being seen trying to pump. So my supply started decreasing like instantly. And I was so stressed out. I almost lost my entire milk supply in that first field problem in that first week. And I was freaking out and I was talking to my mom about it. And My mom was once again home with me and helped me out with the two kids. Having two under the age of two in command, I'd never recommend that to anyone. and so next thing I know, I just was like, my mom obviously being great at sewing, I was like, I have an idea. I was like, how about you just sew zippers onto my t-shirts? And she's like, yeah, tell me what you want to do. And so that's where the idea came from. And so like, I remember I had to like custom order the zippers because I want it to be like two-way, double opening. Like it was very customized and they weren't specifically made that way. Like when you think of it, you think of like industrial things like furniture, suitcases, but not like invisible zippers and like clothing. So did that, hand sewed. And then next field problem, it was just all those worries went away because the way that the shirt worked was I could pump very discreetly and nothing was showing, like no skin. I didn't have to pull the shirt up over my head, like able to keep my dignity intact while I was pumping out in the field as much as you can, right? That was being a leader. That's what West Point teaches us, right? To be a leader, you have a problem, come up with a solution and just go forward with it. I didn't think twice about it. Let's solve it. And let's solve it with the resources that we have right now. And next thing I know, even though I'm still early enough in the stages where I have to go to like all these P3T meetings, even though I'm not doing their PT program, I was doing PT with the guys. And in one meeting, we broke out for a break and, you know, everybody was pumping and I had my shirt the way that I did. And I was just kind of pumping. And then all the other women were like, oh my gosh, I want that. Can I order it? How do I get that? Da, 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 da. And I remember thinking like, oh, there's a good idea here, but let's put a pin in it. Let me get through command first. but that's when my thought kind of came through. So now I'm going to fast forward. So now I'm at Texas A&M getting my MS in kinesiology. I'm a part of the Texas A&M Aggie startup group. But in doing so, before I even did this, I remember posting in our West Point Careers and Network Facebook page. It was basically like through a friend of a friend. They reached out to me. Because I told him, I was like, hey, I have an entrepreneurial idea and not really sure how to get it going. So he reached out to me and he's like, I have someone that you should know and, you know, really busy man, but he's right there in Texas. And his name is Anthony DeToto. We call him Totes and you know, rest his heart, rest his soul. He passed away a few years ago. And so here I was meeting with this big time West Point grad. Like he's just known in our entrepreneurial networking and he's so successful. And I show up with like a piece of paper with a concept and like my current model that I had. You know, I didn't even have like a real prototype other than what was hand sewn when I was in command. And he had every reason to laugh me out of that meeting. Like here he is, like just, he's a busy man. Like he's, you know, working with billion-dollar funds. Like he's, you know, he's working with all these big name companies and big name people. And he took the time to meet with me. And I was a nobody. And that right there, that changed my outlook on life in general, right? You want to talk about someone who just gives back to the community, gives back to West Point, gives back to the network. Anthony DeToto was that man. He didn't care who you were, where you came from, what your net worth was. He gave you his time. And that was so valuable because, and he took me under his wing and he helped me through my entrepreneurial journey. And he introduced me to so many people, so many of the people that I talked to today, so many of the people that are on the, that created the West Point Shared Interest Group. And some of those gentlemen have become my current mentors as well. But yeah. And so I remember like asking him one day, I'm just like, you know, Totes, I'm just so indebted. You know, I'm so thankful for your mentorship. And I don't know how I can ever pay this forward. Like, I don't have the context that you have. I don't have. And he goes, he's like, Nargis, never sell yourself short. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, you can always pay it forward. He's like, you can do two things. One, you give people your time. And two, you give people your gratitude. And I just thought, wow, wow. How true is that? Everybody can give their time. Everybody. And that's that right there is just, so that's always stuck with me. And so in the true spirit of Anthony DeToto, I've always looked at ways of how can I pay it forward? You know, it was that network of, you know, West Point, that network of just Anthony DeToto and his friends and his entrepreneurs. And there's quite a few different groups. I you know, I'm not going to sit here and name all of them, but you know, the West Point AOG Shared Interest Group was a huge proponent of that. And so that's kind of how I looked at it. Like, how can I do? So in that spirit, I remember I had some other entrepreneurial like questions. It's so amazing. It's like a baby. You have this little idea and you see it grow into this mature thing, but there's so many other elements and different stages and phases. And every time I'd be new stage or a new phase, I would have so many questions. And so I remember one day I just went on Facebook and I remember I was just kind of looking up for groups and I was like, there's got to be a West Point entrepreneur group. There's got to be this, there's got to be that. And to my surprise, I found nothing. I put in all the keywords, you know, West Point, USMA, entrepreneur business, nothing came up. And I was like, this is not right. Like, how can we not have this? So the next thing I know, I was like, well, then I'm going to start it. And so next, you know, I started a Facebook page, the West Point Entrepreneur page back in, I think, 2018. And almost immediately we had over 1,000 followers and now we're close to 2,000 and it continues to grow. It's just a page where people come together, like-minded people, they share ideas, they share resources. It's just such an amazing platform and it's a safe space, right? So you don't have to, because I've seen people post on the careers and network page and then they just get blown up.
Never seen that in that entrepreneurs group. And I'm going to be at my first West Point Entrepreneurs Conference this year. I have wanted to go for several years now. And I really sense that it is. It's exactly that. It's this safe space where you can ask questions. And you're absolutely right. Like my entrepreneurial enterprise, I think of it as my third child. It's my opus. It's my passion. But it goes through these different phases. And so you really need that network. And I think it's amazing that we have an alumni network that is so supportive and people are just willing to answer questions and provide you information and connect with resources. Like, it's absolutely amazing. And to see that happening now too with the West Point Women group in general, not just the West Point Women Entrepreneur group, although that is also amazing, but just broadly, you know, to see West Point Women coming together as well. Like, it's just, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. And that's, I feel like that's kind of it's a little bit of a no-brainer. It's what West Point teaches us to be like. As they are growing leaders of character, you think about it, there's so many parallels you can draw from an entrepreneur to a leader of character. Everything from, you know, you have minimal resources. You make do with what you have. You think outside the box. Let's be honest, the enemy is unknown sometimes. Sometimes the enemy has bigger and better resources, more resources, you know? So it's just, there's too many parallels to be drawn. So now, you know, a couple years back there we were, it was my first West Point Women's Conference. And it was such an amazing experience, and I forgot who was talking or how, but somebody mentioned something about entrepreneurship. And then it kind of brought up this other thought in me. And I'm just thinking like, hey, you know, there's all these other schools and alumni networks, and they have these ways of lifting and elevating each other. Like, where is that in West Point Women? And it wasn't so much a question. It was more or less of a statement. And the next thing I know, everybody else is just like, yeah. And then all these people come up with all these other business ideas. Now, at the same time, I remember seeing Kimberly Young there. And I'm a huge fan of Kim. You know, she's one of the co-founders of Athena Angels. I was having like a fan crush. Like, I wanted to go up there and like ask her for her autograph, you know, like, but I was too nervous. I kept staring at her and I would look away. And I kept staring at her and I'd look away. And finally we made eye contact and I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And I get up there and I just was like, hey, Kim, I really just want to introduce myself and I'm such a fan and da da da. And she was like, literally in tears. She's like, are you kidding me? She's like, I'm such a fan of yours. And I'm like, stop. And like, it just so happened, Dr. Alyssa Young, another West Point woman, she happened to be at the same table and we were talking. And you know what's really interesting? This is how I know, like, kind of that fate and that alumni coming back together. All three of us knew Anthony DeToto at different times. And like, at one point in time, he actually tried to get us to connect, not together as a group, but individually. But, you know, sometimes it would fall through and then COVID hit. And so anyways, all these other things. And so we kind of connected over that. And then we got on the topic of West Point Women and how, like, we are so, there's something about a West Point woman. There's something about a grad to begin with, you know, the long gray line, but there's something about our West Point Women network, because you think about it, we had that extra layer of, I don't want to say competition, but that extra layer of challenges. And everybody has their own story of what that challenge meant to them. For me, it was just trying to fit in, and, you know, it just felt like everybody was so competitive, almost at a detriment to us. I mean, everybody at West Point is competitive to begin with. Like, that's, we breed that nature, and healthy competition is good for success. But it was almost like we pinned ourselves in these corners. And so I never really got to, other than my teammates, I really didn't get to know a lot of the other West Point women. We're all driven. We're all type A. And man, I think we have the most mental resiliency. There's never a group of women that just like never quit, right? we were talking about it and we're like, hey, we're kind of underrepresented in the entrepreneur page. Cause I told them at the time, I was like, there's only 8% women in our page. But meanwhile, here at the conference, I just met 13 other women who are running side hustles and side businesses. Like, why are they not on the page? And we're like, we all agreed, like, we need to change this. And so that's kind of how Athena Angels was founded. I mean, we just kind of threw out ideas and whatnot. And then we followed up again later in email. I wrote an email to both Kim and Dr. Young. And I was like, hey, ladies, like, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, let's make this happen. And they both almost immediately just responded like, we're doing this. And just like that, Athena Angels started. And we serve to help West Point women entrepreneurs. We're there to help train, educate, mentor, and promote. As we talked about, like, how does West Point prepare us? And I've already drawn some parallels, but our network is amazing, and I've learned to appreciate that more and more. I remember graduating and leaving West Point and thinking, I'm never coming back, which was the worst mentality to have, right? It was that typical, the cynical cadet mentality. And the next thing I know, you know, I'm coming back for a branch week, and as a lieutenant, I was able to talk to the female cadets and, you know, then coming back as an instructor. And you know what I think makes me the most proud is our current atmosphere at the academy. We have such a respect culture. It's just night and day from when I went through the academy. There just seems to be this respect and understanding and trust among the Corps cadets, male or female. So I came back as an instructor and I taught, my main course was combatives. And I remember one of my male cadets was asking me, so ma'am, did you go infantry and ranger school? And it just took me aback because he just assumed this. He assumed that was the norm. And I just had this big grin on my face, like, oh my goodness, you know, because to this day, like when I meet with older people or, you know, they're like, oh, you're still artillery. They, you know, they kind of get that surprised look on their face. And I'm like, yeah, dude, it's 2023. Of course, like, come on. You know, another time I taught combatives all the way until I was 9 months pregnant with my third child. And I was still doing the moves, right? Combatives is all about technique, obviously doing everything in a safe manner. But I had another male cadet come up to me and just say how much he admired me and respected me as a leader. And I would have like, oh my gosh, I was so happy because even in my artillery career, I don't think I ever had my male subordinates mention that. They may have thought it, but they never would have mentioned it or said it out loud because I think there's something there a little bit about pride and ego. But I just love this shift in paradigm and how the male peers are really supporting the female peers. And not only that, the female peers are supporting each other. And that was something I used to harp on when I was in artillery, to just any females that I would mentor, because there weren't too many females to mentor in artillery. And for me growing up, I had zero, nobody, I didn't know any other females in artillery. As I mentioned, they were all in the 80s. You know, they laid the groundwork for me and then it's like they all disappeared. It's like they were unicorns. I've heard of them, but I never met them, right? I would tell the ladies all the time, like, you know, obviously we talked about the physical fitness and being competent. I was like, but last but not least, be good to each other, like meaning females, women to women, be good to each other because it's hard enough out there. It's so hard. Last thing you need is to put each other down. And I still stand by those words, you know? And so I think the West Point atmosphere, that respect culture has really grown to where it needs to be. I mean, there's always room for improvement, but man, just how much we've come this far. It makes me proud to be a part of the Corps from where I can be there as an instructor. I currently work in admissions. Just seeing that is pretty amazing. And so other ways that obviously West Point, you know, helped me be successful. We talked about, you know, the physical pillar, just how true and how important it was, just facing your fears, facing your adversity, but providing you with a safety net, right? Like they weren't going to let you drown, but you thought you were going to drown. Like that was huge. The time management aspect, right? So I had to work hard for my grades. I was not naturally smart, but how my instructors were always there to help. So that was huge. And I think that also bleeds into our network, not just on the entrepreneur side, but I ran into a lot of my old instructors and my mentors in my military career. And they were so quick to mentor me there as they were when we were cadets. And so just talk about like right place and right time, just an amazing, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I've learned to appreciate the West Point network and the Long Gray Line more and more the further I get from when I graduated, the further I get from, you know, where when I was there. And even little things like wearing my West Point ring, and then out of nowhere, someone will point it out and they'll have a story, you know, either for themselves or, you know, grandparent or mom, dad. So just, I feel really blessed to have been a part of the alumni, and all because there was a basketball recruit my high school senior year saying, hey, I think you'd be good for this school. Clearly history was not my best subject because I had no idea what West Point was about. But so yeah. And I think for people out there who resonate with my story, whether they're trying to make cultural impacts or society impacts, or whether it's their military career, or maybe it's entrepreneurship, my dad told me three things, and I remember it. You know, I remember it to this day, even though he passed away many, many years ago. His three things were work hard, get an education. And, you know, I even say that education piece, that goes back to being competent in your area, right? Like, you don't have to go around getting PhDs or collecting master's degrees. Like, just be smart in your area. It doesn't take a lot. Constantly read and work on self-improvement. And the third thing he would say is never give up. And how true, right? How true, never give up. And I'm going to add the fourth one, and we kind of hit on it, but the fourth one falls in line with character. Be kind and be humble along your journey, because you just never know who you're going to run into and who needs your kindness, and being humble and being grateful for those around you. I know I'm in so much gratitude for so many people that have impacted my life so far. So,
and I love that you have shared that, and so many things in your story I resonate with. Even the women at the academy, while we were there as cadets, we didn't naturally connect with one another unless we were on a team together. But as I have come back to reunions, the other women in my class are like, why weren't we closer to each other? Like, let's be closer to each other now. Like in April, two of my classmates are organizing a class West Point women reunion in Austin, which is just amazing to just bring together the women of our class, you know, reunion style. So things like that we're doing, it's really close to my heart that strong women uplift and encourage each other and really empower each other and are cheering each other on for their success. And that's actually how I became connected with you. You were a speaker on a panel at the last West Point Women's Conference that I was at. And I admired you so much. I totally was like a 14-year-old at a Taylor Swift concert. And that's how I met you, is you came down from that. And I was like, oh my God, I have to meet her. And I don't even remember what I said. I probably just like blubbered all over and was like, you're so impressive and amazing. Then we connected and you were kind and humble. And we established that we were both DPE instructors, we're both entrepreneurs. And now I am so grateful to consider you my friend and someone that I draw so much inspiration from. So I think everything that you shared is incredibly powerful, from the power of our alumni network to everything that West Point prepared you for and taught you. You just have an incredible story. So I think this is going to be game changing. You're just going to continue like changing the game, changing the world, changing minds. Like, it's amazing.
Thank you. And I, you know, everybody has a story. Your story is amazing. You've overcome adversity. Everybody has a story. And I'm really grateful that I got to share it with you and West Point AOG. And thank you for having me today.
This has been a production of the WPAOG Broadcast Network. Please take a moment to rate and review the show and join us each week for a new episode. Thank you for listening.